Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studio of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, the 25th of January, 2018. I want to ask you to please have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down all the names, addresses, emails, web pages, and phone numbers so you can take action for the environment. And let's start with announcements. The Earth First Winter Rendezvous with workshops, trainings, and movement building will be taking place February 23rd through the 26th in southern Mississippi. If you want more information, send email to byobef@riseup.net. That's byobef@riseup.net. Or you could go to the webpage, www.bellyofthebeastef.wordpress.com. That's bellyofthebeastef.wordpress.com. And the Earth First Journal needs money. This isn't the first time and certainly won't be the last time the journal is asking this. And we're grateful to all of you who have donated in the past and those who will do so in the future. One of the main reasons why we have to constantly ask for money is because we're bad capitalists. We're good at making magazines. We're great about giving away copies to our friends. But we don't feel the same energy when it comes to turning a profit. This is where we rely on you, our readers and supporters, to help make the Earth First Journal happen. It would be great one day if we were self-sufficient, and we're definitely headed down this path. But for now, we still need the occasional boost like this one. Please send your checks or money orders or cash, if that's your thing, to Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 964, Lake Worth, Florida, 33460. That's Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 964, Lake Worth, Florida, 33460. Or you could go to the earthfirstjournal.org webpage and find their donate page. They also have lots of stuff that you can buy. And the California Native Plant Society Habitat Restoration Team in Santa Cruz is having a restoration this Saturday, the 27th of January, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quayla Hollow Ranch County Park. Linda writes, the Zayanti Sandhills are a unique community of plants and animals found only in these sandy rock outcrops in the central portion of Santa Cruz County. There's been lots of wonderful rain recently. Come out and join us removing invasive non-native French broom while helping to restore this unique habitat. You get to Quail Hollow by going up Graham Hill Road from Santa Cruz. As you come down a hill into Felton, turn right at the light and drive 2 miles up East Zayanti Road. Turn left on Quail Hollow Road. The park entrance is a half mile up on the right. They'll meet you in the parking lot on the left side of the entrance road. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. Prior work experience is not necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Please wear comfortable layered clothing. Bring something to drink and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. It should be shiny this weekend. But if things get particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. Tools are provided. Please bring your gloves and water. For more information, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number, 831-462-4041. That's 831-462-4041. Or send her email at redwoodrn, R-E-D-W-D-R-N, at pacbell.net. Or go to their website, www.cruzcnps.org. That's C-R-U-Z-C-N-P-S.org. And two indigenous activists have locked shut the doors of the Department of Fisheries and Oceans office in British Columbia in this story from Warrior Publications as found on the Earth First newsletter. Two activists have been arrested for refusing to remove themselves from the Department of Fisheries and Oceans office situated on unseen territory native lands near Victoria, British Columbia. After a complete dismissal of their demands for justice from the federal and provincial governments of Canada, they have said enough is enough. The door-locking action was carried out in solidarity with the many Indigenous nations opposing illegal fish farms, which are contaminating their unceded territories and destroying wild salmon populations at a devastating rate. Meanwhile, along with other unconstitutional violations, the Departments of Fisheries and Oceans are currently in direct violation of a 2015 Supreme Court order mandating they stop allowing the transfer and foreign holding of diseased Atlantic fish in the migratory back eddies of wild Pacific salmon, which they have a duty to protect. And an Indigenous forest defender has been killed in Brazil in this story by Jonathan Watts of The Guardian, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Serra Caapor patrolled one of the most murderous frontiers in the world, a remote and largely lawless region of the Brazilian Amazon, where his indigenous community has fought for generations to protect their forested land. Armed with clubs, bows and arrows, GPS trackers, and crude guns, he and his fellow members of the Caapor Forest Guard drove off and sometimes attacked loggers who intruded into their territory, the 530,000-hectare, that's about a million-acre, Alto Tiracu indigenous lands, which is roughly three times the area of Greater London and contains about half of the Amazon forest left in Brazil's northern Maranhão state. That vigilante role came to an end last April when Saira was stabbed to death in Betel, a logging town close to Caapor territory. This was a murder that took place in a fragile, dangerous world, balanced precariously between values of conservation and consumption, tradition and modernity. The death has gone uninvestigated by police and unreported by the Brazilian media, but it highlights the violent pressures driving forest clearance. For decades, loggers have cut dirt tracks into the forest that allow them to selectively fell valuable timber such as ipê, which can fetch almost 1,000 pounds per cubic meter after processing and export. This is followed by fires, often set deliberately, that destroy the remaining trees so land can be used for cattle ranching or soy farming. Last year, 6,624 square kilometers, more than four times the area of London, was deforested in Brazil. This was the first time in 3 years that the rate did not increase, and the country remains off track to reach its Paris climate targets. Numerous studies have shown that protection of indigenous land is the most effective way to cut deforestation, but the Caapor, like many other tribes, feel the police often work against them. Battling to save the forest is a risky business. According to Global Witness, Brazil is the deadliest country in the world for environmental and land defenders, with 44 killings recorded in 2017. Maranhão, the nation's poorest state, is among the worst affected. There were more death attacks and threats on indigenous groups here than anywhere else in 2016, according to the Pastoral Land Commission. Saira knew the dangers. He was utterly fearless, recalls a senior member of the Caapor Council, Itahu, who described how his fellow defender was in the vanguard of a successful operation in 2014 to intercept and burn three logging trucks. The village of Zimborenda is home to 2,200-strong Caapor community where Saira lived. At night, fireflies glow while frogs and insects provide an undulating chorus of noise. Tarantulas crawl along bedroom walls. The biodiversity is testimony to the quality of the forest in a place that defiantly holds out against extractive industries and global markets. But the pressure on this natural wealth is relentless. The Caapor Council has attempted to hold the line, but many individuals succumb to temptations. Nothing is black and white. The loggers were also neighbors. Many were poor. There was intermarriage. People would fight the loggers 1 year, befriend them the next, then go back to fighting. Even Saara once sold trees on his land in exchange for cachaca and cask, but later gave up alcohol and led the campaign to stop others in his village from drinking and trading wood. Loggers use alcohol to weaken us. It's a more powerful weapon than guns, said Itahu. He believes Ciara was murdered as part of a long-running intimidation campaign. Many counselors have experienced threats. Sarapo Kaapur described how he was captured by a gang of loggers in 2013. They held my arms behind my back, fired their guns repeatedly so close to my ears that I went temporarily deaf. One bullet actually grazed my scalp and I was drenched in blood. Nobody saw the murder. The bar owner's wife, who only gave the name of Doña Raimundo, assumed there had been a fight on the way back. She and Sarah's sister-in-law came back to the bar, saying he had been stabbed by a relative called Presidio. But Kaapur counselors refused to accept one of their community would kill another. The last time that happened was more than 20 years ago, and the traditional punishment is being buried alive. But Sarah and Presidio have been close friends from childhood. They went hunting together. I can't believe he killed him, said Iratui Kaapur, who taught them both. And a Kenyan forest death activist blamed the European Union for ignoring human rights warnings. And this story found in The Guardian. And the European Union has been accused of a fatally slow response to human rights warnings after the killing of an indigenous man at one of the projects it funds in Kenya. Robert Kurotich of the Sengwer, one of the country's last forest people, was reportedly shot by the Kenya Forest Service during a forced eviction for the EU-funded 31 million euro water conservation project in the Mount Elgon and Shirangani Hills. Members of the community said the forest guards sprayed bullets at a group of 15 men who had been herding cattle in Kapkot Glade. The attackers reportedly burned homes, injured another man, David Kapkosegi Kiptelesi, and killed Karotich. We have been trying all along to avoid such a bad situation, but the European Union and the government have ignored our cries, Sengwer activist Elias Kamayo wrote in an email to the Forest Protection Program NGO. Stefan Dejak, EU ambassador to Kenya, has condemned the killing and followed through on a warning to the Kenyan government that the use of force would result in a suspension of funding. The project will only resume if guarantees are provided that it benefits and protects all Kenyans, indigenous communities included, Dejak told The Guardian. But this response has been criticized as tardy. Thousands of homes have reported to have been burned down by the Kenyan Forest Service rangers in a dispute over the highlands covered by the Mbobo Forest, which is an important water source. Conflict over the land dates back to the British colonial era. More recently, it has flared up as a result of the government's decision to classify the ancestral territory of the Sengwer and Ojek people as a conservation area. The residents have been designated as squatters and forced to flee what they say has been government harassment, intimidation, and unrest. They received global attention in 2014 when hundreds of NGOs warned of the cultural genocide and the World Bank admitted its carbon offset project in the area violated safeguards. The EU became involved in 2016 when it agreed to fund the Water Towers Protection and Climate Change Mitigation Program, which covers the contested territory. Dejak said the social and human rights impacts were assessed in a feasibility study during the inception phase, but Sengwer protesters say their warnings were ignored. Justin Kenrick of the Forest Peoples Program said the EU funded the Kenyan Forestry Service and took a step back from the World Bank by failing to recognize the existence of the Sengwer and Ojek people. The EU's response has been extremely poor and entirely inconsistent with EU policy on indigenous peoples, he said. The EU did not learn from the mistakes of the World Bank project. And the first wolf in 100 years has been recorded in Belgium in this story by Daniel Boffy of The Guardian, as found on the Earth First Newswire. The first recorded wolf in Belgian soil for at least 100 years has made her bloody mark. Farmers in northeast Flanders have been put on high alert after evidence emerged that Naya, a female originally from eastern Germany that has been making pioneering trek across Europe, had killed two sheep and injured a third near the Belgian town of Merhout. Naya's arrival in Belgium completes the return of the predator to every mainland country in Europe, turning back decades of persecution, although not every community might welcome the wolf. Any sheep farmer should know that they are in the range of this wolf, said Hugh Jansman, a researcher in the Wageningen University and Research Center, who has been following Naya's westward trek across 100 miles of the European landscape. Naya, who will turn 2 in May, was given a collar with a tracking device when she was 6 months old by the Technical University of Dresden, but it was only in October last year that she had left her parental pack in the rural Lumthener Heide between Hamburg and Berlin to push the boundaries for wolfkind and strike out across Germany, into Netherlands, and finally across the border to Belgium on the 3rd of January. She has seemingly settled in a large military area near the town of Leopoldsburg, about 15 miles from the Dutch border in Flemish Belgium, Jansman said. But Naya's arrival is only the latest sign of the swift repopulation of Europe by the predators. Last year, scientists revealed evidence that a breeding pack of wolves had settled in West Jutland in Denmark, the first in the country for over 200 years. We are at the front of a migratory wave of wolves, Jansman said. In 2000, the first wolf pack with cubs was in eastern Germany. Currently, there are 74 cubbed packs with cubs in eastern Germany. And in Lower Saxony, closest to the Dutch border, in 2012, there was only one settled female, but there currently are 14 packs of cubs. Agricultural areas are being abandoned by people, so they are rewilding again, leaving lots of space for carnivores. The countryside is being abandoned by young people who are moving to the cities. This increase in wolves' numbers and distribution is going quite rapidly, so it is not a matter of if wolves are coming to the Netherlands and probably Belgium, but how fast. We have seen in recent weeks how fast they can go. The data from Naya's transmitter suggests she has been covering between 30 and 70 kilometers a night, traversing swamplands and forests as she sought a home in which to establish her own pack, with reports in the Netherlands of dead sheep neatly tallying with her movements. Some wolves just stay in their area. Some others, about 20%, go on a trek and walk hundreds of kilometers and then settle down, Jansman said. Naya is in the blue ocean as there is so much free habitat for her. An endangered orangutan shot before being decapitated in Indonesia in this story from Reuters. A critically endangered Bornean orangutan found dead in Indonesia's central Kalimantan province on Monday died 3 days earlier from an air rifle wound before it was decapitated, Indonesia's Center for Orangutan Protection said. Authorities previously said the great ape appeared to have been stabbed multiple times in the latest in a string of unnatural orangutan deaths on the island to which they are native. A necropsy carried out by police and the center found 17 air rifle pellets in the male orangutan corpse, proving it died because of humans, said Ramad Hani, the center's habitat protection manager. Our strong suspicion is that this orangutan died because it was shot using an air rifle through the heart, lungs, and stomachs, he said in a statement on the center's website. The World Wildlife Fund estimates there are 104,700 Bornean orangutans known for their broad faces and dark brown fur left in the world. And an endangered Mexican gray wolf has been found dead in Arizona, in this story by the Associated Press, as found in the New York Post. Federal authorities are investigating the death of a Mexican gray wolf as wildlife managers prepare for an annual survey of the endangered species along the Arizona-New Mexico border. Officials with the wolf recovery effort announced Tuesday that a female wolf was found dead in December in Arizona. They declined to release more information, saying the case is still under investigation. For 2017, there were a total of 12 documented wolf deaths and one removal of a wolf from the wild that resulted in his death. According to the most recent count, there are at least 113 wolves in the wild in Arizona and New Mexico. Officials with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service say a new survey of the population will begin next week. The effort will take a couple of weeks to finish. And cougars have been officially declared extinct in the eastern United States and have been removed from the endangered species list. Eastern cougars once roamed every U.S. state east of the Mississippi, but it has been 8 decades since the last confirmed sighting of the animal. Now the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has officially declared the subspecies extinct and has removed it from the U.S. Endangered Species List. The decision announced Monday is the result of years of deliberation. The agency conducted an extensive review of the eastern cougar in 2011 and recommended it be removed from the Endangered and Threatened Species List in 2015, Reuters reported. The species, also known as pumas, are the genetic cousins of mountain lions in the western United States and of Florida panthers, which are now found only in the Everglades. And that story from the Environmental News Network. And from the Mother Nature Network, we read that illegal pot farms are endangering spotted owls. Rat poison from illicit sites is seeping into California's ecosystem in this story by Michael Destries of the Mother Nature Network. A new study examining the presence of rodenticides in northern spotted owls has found an alarming rise in exposure to rat poison emanating from illegal marijuana farms. Writing in the journal Avian Conservation and Ecology, researchers at UC Davis, in cooperation with the California Academy of Sciences, say the boom in unpermitted and private farms near critical forest habitat is likely the driving force behind the spike. When you have thousands of unpermitted grows and only a handful of biologists that regulate that for multiple counties, we're deeply concerned that there aren't sufficient conservation protective measures in place, lead author Morad Gabriel said in a statement. If no one is investigating the level at which private marijuana cultivators are placing chemicals in the wild, the fragmented forest landscapes created by these sites can serve as source points for exposure for owls and other wildlife. Researchers conducted their study by collecting dead specimens of northern spotted owls, a threatened species under federal and California State Endangered Species Act, along with barred owl tissue samples from an unrelated project. They discovered that 7 of the 10 spotted owls and 40% of the barred owls tested positive for rat poison. Spotted owls are inclined to feed along forest edges, added Gabriel. Because grow sites break apart these forest landscapes, they are likely source points for exposure. Exposure to high doses of rat poison can cause clotting and coagulation complications, leading eventually to uncontrollable internal bleeding. Even sublethal doses, as research ecologist Craig Thompson told Mother Nature News in 2016, can later result in mortal wounds. There's a lot of records of animals coming into wildlife rehab that end up dying from rodenticide poisoning because it's usually small injuries, he said. They'll bleed out, essentially. I found one great horned owl bled out from a mouse that bit it on the toe. As you might expect, the impact of rat poisons from illegal marijuana farms has also been documented as deadly to black bears, gray foxes, and other animals down the food chain. In an earlier study by Gabriel, who also serves as executive director of the nonprofit Integral Ecology Research Center, found 85% of 101 fishers tested positive over a 4-year period to exposure to rodenticides. And scientists and volunteers rescue about 1,000 cold-stunned turtles in this story from the Environmental News Network. On the icy cold shores of Florida's St. Joseph Bay, a team of volunteers and wildlife experts have rescued an estimated 1,000 cold-stunned sea turtles since January 2nd in what is believed to be Florida's second-largest mass cold-stunned event of the 21st century, according to the U.S. Geological Survey research biologist Margaret Lamont. Lamont has been coordinating the turtle rescues in cooperation with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. About 50 people, with 30 volunteers from the Florida Coastal Conservancy, volunteers of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Elgin Air Force Base, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, Gulf World Marine Park, and 2 more USGS scientists have taken part in the rescues January 2nd to 7th, when about 700 turtles were rescued, and January 17th through 19th, when 300 more were brought in. So many cold-stunned turtles have been rescued from the bay's waters and mud flats that Gulf World, where the turtles are taken to rest and recover, is full and can only take in injured animals, she said. A rented house where Lamont and two scientists conduct their research was full of turtles inside and outside on Friday, January the 19th. The vast majority of the turtles rescued were threatened green turtles, but teams also brought in endangered Kemp's Ridleys, loggerheads, and endangered Hawksbill's turtles. And the African Wildlife Foundation has expanded its mountain gorilla sanctuary. AWF, in partnership with the government of Rwanda and Rwanda Development Board, has expanded Africa's oldest park for the first time in over 30 years. On January 10th, African Wildlife Foundation donated a 27.8 acre property to the government of Rwanda and Rwanda Development Board. The donated land is adjacent to Volcanoes National Park, located in the narrowest part of the park in an area where the critically endangered mountain gorillas wander across the park boundary. This increases the risk of human-gorilla conflict and the danger of exposure to deadly diseases. Less than 1,000 of the mountain gorillas remain in the world today, and they are found only in two regions. The Virunga Massif in Volcanoes National Park is located in Bawindi Impenetrable Forest. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can hear a rebroadcast tomorrow afternoon, that's Friday at 3 p.m., during our Environment Friday programming. You could also listen to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Friday at 5:30 in the morning. KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m. And WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. Or you could listen to KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill and Gilroy, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California, and Berkeley Liberation Radio at 104.1. You could also tune in on the web at Grateful Dread Public Radio, that's GDPRRevolution.com, Sundays at 2 a.m. Central Time. That's GDPRRevolution.com, or you could always go to RadioForAll.net. That's Radio, the number, ForAll.net, where you can listen online or download this or any previous Earth First Update. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and to broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.